back to another episode of the Raw Knowledge Podcast. As ever, with myself, Alex Connor, and I'm here with another talented guest, joined by Tash Price. Thank you for joining me this morning.
Hi.
Appreciate it.
No worries.
We're outside of EMF. We're in the new, or should I say new, old, established. We had a little working space area. It's back here. It's back open now, which is great. So we're going to be maxing, relaxing, and join us for this conversation. So I guess let's start where we always do. Tash, tell us about you.
Hi, so I'm Tash Price. I am a wheelchair athlete. Can't see my wheelchair right now because I'm sat very, very comfortably on this seat and quite enjoying it. So I'm here from the Gold Coast, but originally you might be able to tell from the accent, from the
fellow
UK.
Fellow Brit.
Yes, I haven't managed to shake it. I don't think we ever do.
No, it just amalgamates.
Yeah,
people
know,
go, are
right.
You Irish? And you go, what?
Irish, really?
I get all sorts. I know, and I go, really?
Yeah. It's funny, I often get asked if I'm from Yorkshire, and I'm not quite sure why. I mean, I've lived all over the UK, but only spent a couple of years in Yorkshire, so I don't really understand where that...
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe it's... some dilution, or perhaps, you know, if you speak to your family, it gets a bit thicker sometimes, often. And then people
true.
Go, oh, hang on, you just come over, and you go, oh, no.
No.
So it can be an amalgamation of your environment. But I've even had South African. And I'm like,
oh, South African?
And I'm like, that's, and I sort of do the accents of people.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not, like, if no. this would be Afrikaans, mate, you know, like, it's.
That's very strange. I don't hear that at all.
I think people are just not listening. I'm like, either that or it's a bad joke.
Oh, well, yeah, that could be the point too. Strong accents will do that. I remember I used to live in the States, used to live in America, and I often got asked if I was Australian, and I'm like, okay, I'm okay with that. I can sort of understand why the Americans might think that.
Yeah, it's quite neutral, some of the Australian accent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember getting asked once if I was Dutch. I was like, well, that's very unusual, especially as I'm speaking English right now.
Yeah, and the Dutch is quite an accent, even speaking in English.
Exactly right. There you go.
Yeah, that is, it's quite interesting.
Yeah. But,
yeah, we are worldly creatures.
Yes.
That's for sure.
Yeah, travelled a lot throughout my life, so there you go.
And I'd love to get onto some of that. I guess, you know, you've told us sort of who you are and a bit of an identity. I love to start with, like, why? So, you know, what you do, but why is it that you do what you do? And maybe take us back to wherever you would like to, and maybe walk us through a little bit of that journey so we can see, you know, how you've got to where you are now and obviously competing as an athlete.
Absolutely. Quick point, though, I don't walk anywhere.
This is true.
So
roll and roll.
Exactly. So I guess for me, my journey starts with becoming very, very ill one day in 2008. So it was Christmas Day. I go to bed as normal. 2008. I'm staying with.
How old were you at this point?
So I was 27.
Right.
Yeah, 27. Okay. So I've gone to bed completely normal. No signs that there's anything wrong at all, and wake up the next morning, Boxing Day, with a big black spot in the center of my right eye. Couldn't see a thing, you know, through that spot. On the outside, it was fine, but just, you know, this central bit of vision had been completely blocked, and thinking to myself, oh, this is a little bit weird.
So it was an actual black spot.
Yeah, it was. It probably...
Like a pupil. Another pupil.
Yeah, exactly. And it was blocking about, I'd say, about 50% of my vision in that eye.
And you were sort of looking
at
it. Going,
I was, I was kind of trying to put my head all over the place to be able to see what was going on. Being Christmas time, couldn't get an appointment to try and figure out what was going on. But I kind of figured out, it'll probably disappear.
Yes.
I'm a person that's had a lot of health issues throughout my life. So I just kind of thought, it'll be all right. Took maybe a week or so to get an appointment to see somebody. But by the time that appointment happened, the vision had completely gone in my right eye. Couldn't see the difference between night and day out of it. It was just like 100% gray. My left eye was fine, but my right wasn't. However, in the time it took me to get an appointment with the optometrist, and the time that it took the optometrist to say to me, oh, this isn't right, you probably need to go to hospital. So it was probably 2 days. the vision in both eyes had completely gone. So at that point, I was 99% blind. Couldn't see. Yeah, like I hardly knew if it was nighttime or daytime.
What was going through your mind at that point? Like as a 27-year-old, and I know you've been through a bit.
It's a really good question. I think there was a little bit of panic there, but not as much as you'd expect. Like if you said to someone right now, shit, this is a really scary experience. I can't imagine just losing my eyesight like that. You'd think that you just wouldn't cope, but I don't know. There was something just inside me that just kept me thinking, oh, I'll be all right. This will get sorted. Mm. It won't be a problem. Mm. Unfortunately, though, I ended up spending 4 weeks in hospital. They couldn't quite figure out what was going on. They gave me steroid infusions and did multiple tests. And the only thing they could figure out that there was something neurological going on, that I had some form of swelling of the optic nerve behind my eye, but they had absolutely no idea what was causing it.
Was this black spot still the same and it was only in one eye? Or?
So the black spot had just, I guess, grown so that at that point, both of my eyes were just covered.
Your eyes look black almost?
So just out of not from just looking at me, but when they looked into my eyes, they could see it. They could see that it was there. It turned out that I had this optic neuritis, swelling of the optic nerve, and they couldn't figure out what was going on. They couldn't restore my vision. They had absolutely no idea, so they just sent me home on my merry way to go and learn to live as a blind person. At the time, I wasn't in a wheelchair. I had no idea that there was anything more significant going on. I got told that probably with time that my vision would return and that I'd likely be okay, but in the meantime I should get used to using a white cane. At that point I was at university in Leeds, so I was in a student-based accommodation. I was doing my master's degree, and my family were in Australia, so I had to go and live back in my hometown so that my extended family were close by. Mm-hmm. And I actually ended up in a homeless shelter because I didn't have anywhere to go. My student accommodation was in Leeds. My family are down in Hereford, which is, a 4-hour drive away. And there was nobody that could, in my extended family, that could cater to my needs at that point. Nobody with like spare rooms or anything like that. So a homeless shelter was where I ended up. So if you can imagine living in a shelter that sadly had to cater to about 50% of its residents with drug and alcohol dependency, and I was newly blind, now that was scary. There was a lot of, luckily they separated the two sides of the facility, so I wasn't in the thick of it, but at night you used to hear a lot of commotion and things going on, which when you can't see anything and you're unsure of your environment, and that was the point where I became very scared and worried and emotional about things. But it was more because of the environment and that I wasn't
the unpredictability.
And I wasn't comfortable with it, instead of actually the fact that I'd lost my vision. It's really strange, but I've always managed to cope with that, my health issues very, very well. But it's the outside factors. It's the inability to control what's going on around you that becomes the problem, not the fact that you actually have a disability or have things going on.
Which is a really salient point.
Yeah.
I'm sure, like myself, a lot of people listening and watching are just going, that resilience comes to mind there, because that's character building stuff.
Yeah, the thing is, I think experiences like that, you can either allow them to make you or break you. There's no middle. There's no middle ground. You either become depressed and don't really know what direction to take in life anymore. You can become angry at the world and feel like you've been cheated and stolen of your life, which is, which is hugely understandable.
Yeah, fair enough.
But in my mind, it's like, well, who are you helping? All you're going to do is make yourself feel like crap. all you're going to do is make the people around you feel like crap. So having that mindset is going to only affect you and affect those you love. Mm. Why do that to yourself? Yes, these situations suck and they take time to get used to, but at the same time, you have to find a way forward. You just have to. There's no choice in the matter, because you're the one that's going to end up stuck. The world and life isn't made for disability. It isn't. That's just the way it is. But if you find ways to adapt, you can also have a wonderful life, which is, you know,
what you've done,
what I've done, and where I'm at now. But it took a long time to get there. So after I became blind, I was in that facility for like 4 weeks.
And you didn't think about, I'm just thinking in your shoes,
yeah,
going back to your family, Hereford, you thought, no, I'm going to do what I can.
No, I wanted to remain independent. At that point, financially, I wasn't in the situation where I could travel back to Australia to be with my parents and my younger sister. So I was stuck there. My extended family didn't have room for me, so I had to be, I was close to them, but obviously I had to be in the facility. There was no choice. And I know they felt terrible about that, but it was just the way it was at the time. I say luckily, but 4 weeks after I was put in that facility, I started getting a strange lower back pain, and ended up back in hospital again. Hmm. And over the course of a few days, I lost the ability to use my legs.
Oh,
so
geez.
I became paralyzed from the waist down. And from that episode, they found out that the visual impairment and the paralysis, it was all
autoimmune.
That it was a neurological disease, but from my autoimmune system, from my immune system. So
you must have just, I mean, I'm just trying to imagine where you're at. What you just think, for fuck's sake. Like,
yeah.
You said you don't want to feel sorry for yourself. You just go, really? Like,
yeah.
this? Yeah. Like, you just, it's almost like you just look up and go, is someone fucking with
yeah.
me?
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. It was, I mean, my reaction literally was, I don't fucking believe this. Can it just
like,
stop?
What's next? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But good things happened because of me losing the ability to use my legs. I was taken out of that facility.
And they were able to.
Well, I did get a diagnosis at the time, but they've gone back on that diagnosis now. So, so at the time, they decided I had something called neuromyelitis optica, which is a little bit like MS, but much more aggressive.
Yeah.
So it affects the spinal cord and the optic nerve in the same way that MS does, but it also tends to have greater disability and it's much faster in the way it affects your body. And at the time, so this, you know, 2008, it was something that only had a 5-year life expectancy. That's changed now, luckily, but as I digress, they've now said that I probably don't have that disease, but I have a variant of it. A lot rarer, but
I was gonna say, so are you in some respects a pioneering example of something that's a bit of a divergent? It's not we know exactly what this is. Mm. It's a combination of things, because my mum does have MS, unfortunately, and I understand, like, it's not nice.
So
it's very cruel.
They think that there's spinal cord and optic nerve activity, but that it's likely also to do with my type 1 diabetes. So that they've all kind of intermingled and decided to give me this party of an illness, which...
That's one way to describe it.
I'm certainly a unique bugger. But so anyway, I was taken out of the facility, and I ended up in hospital for 7 months whilst I was having to have chemotherapy to try and kill off my immune system and rebuild it again afterwards. I was having to have plasma exchange, which is kind of like a transfusion. They take out all of your blood's plasma and then replace it with new stuff, because they figure that the antibodies in the plasma were what causing the issues for me.
Apparently that's a bit painful.
Yeah, there's a lot going on at the time. I went from a size 6 up to a size 26 because of the steroids and the chemo and all the, I lost my hair. I was 100% blind. I had no use of my lower body at all. It was it was a very, 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 very tough time.
I can imagine.
But I guess it's all part of my story, you know.
If I had not
been through all this stuff, I wouldn't be the person I am today, doing the things I do.
At those moments where you were at your most vulnerable, when there was the most going on in your life, when you know, like you said, it feels like everything's against you, and you see almost your identity fade away from a physical perspective, especially as a young person.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I guess, a basic example is if a young person loses their hair. You know, they, ooh, you know, it's, because it's like, well, no, that's part of me.
Yeah.
And obviously we have to create these different, or discreate and think about.
Just a quick one, guys, before we carry on with the podcast. For any of you who are interested in taking your health and physique to the next level and you want to remove the guesswork, you're not quite getting the progress that you want, you're not seeing what you want to see in the mirror, and you're not feeling like you're really moving in the right direction, then click the link in the bio below, the apply button, where you can contact me. We can organize a free consultation, no obligation, and discover whether it's a good fit as coach and client. All right, back to it.
It's what's in here and what's in here,
exactly.
Depending on what people believe. But were there any thoughts, feelings, people, memories, something, anchors that helped you through that period when you were probably at your wit's end?
The funny thing is, it took me probably 8 or 9 years of continual relapses, and some were worse than others, where I ended up completely paralyzed from the neck down for about a year, unable to move. That was in 2012. And that was petrifying. That was really scary, because I could barely communicate, let alone anything else. Touch wood, I've been stable since that last relapse, so hopefully it remains that way.
But, yeah, absolutely.
It took many, many years of relapses, and I, you know, for want of a better phrase, being completely confined to bed and unable to do anything for myself before I started to realise that things needed to change and that I needed to take control of things. So I've always been very positive, always been like, you know, it is what it is. You play the hand you've been dealt, you just get on with it. But I think the thoughts and opinions of my care team, the people that were supposed to be there to look out for me, really, really affected what I believed I could do. So when you go through these illnesses or rehab or any of that kind of stuff, you know, they help you set up your home. They help you to find work if you're able to work. They help you find carers. They don't help you to actually plan for your future and help you to understand, do you know what? I can still do whatever the hell I want. I just have to do it in a different way.
Adapt.
I just have to adapt to my situation. And there's no mentorship from people that are in similar situations to kind of help you to figure that stuff out. So for me, it was a 10-year journey, because there just wasn't that out there. So I was always making jokes, I was always laughing, I was always smiling, but I just lay there in bed all day watching TV because I didn't think that I could do anything else. But it changed for me in, would have been 2017, 2018. I was watching TV, and the wheelchair marathoner, Kurt Fernley, everybody knows him, world record holder, just, you know, incredible guy, was doing the Gold Coast Marathon, I believe. And the TV's following him and talking about his incredible journey and how he's an ambassador for the sport and he's an incredible guy.
Were you back in Australia at this
point?
I was in Australia
at this point.
Yeah.
So I got back to Australia in 2010. So I've been here permanently since then.
Just a quick digression out of interest.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you find there's a big discrepancy with the medical care in the UK versus in this part of the world?
It's
and if
very,
so, what is it?
It's very, very different. I find, for me personally, it's been better here. The NHS is brilliant. They've got some fantastic doctors. It's very, very much under a lot of stress, even before COVID. And I think the lack of funding and the speed at which you can access things is a problem. Here, you've got an issue. You've got your blood test results back within a few days. You've had your radiology done within a day or two. You're with your doctor within a couple of days, whereas there, it can be weeks and weeks and weeks. And I think if you've got something that's a problem that urgently needs sorting, it's really important that you have that speed. Waiting months and months and months and months, which you often have to do in the UK just for the simple steps, can be really, really detrimental if you've got some kind of really serious disease. And that was my main deciding factor in getting back to Australia, is I knew that I would get quicker medical care here. Whilst we lag behind often with how quickly technology and things catch up, when it comes to speed and stuff, I think we're kind of miles ahead. So I think everybody has to weigh up for themselves what is more important. But for me, that was definitely an important deciding factor.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, you said I put it in. You were here and you were watching the Gold Coast Marathon.
Yeah, watching the Gold Coast Marathon. So I've got a big TV up on my bedroom wall, big 55-inch curved screen TV.
Nice.
I'm there watching the, I need it so that I can see something. I haven't mentioned that I've, at this point, I've got some vision in my left eye, but nothing in my right eye still. So I'm considered legally blind in my right eye and low vision in my left.
Is this still the same now?
So yes, it's still the same now. I was kind of on the journey to where it's at now at this point. So the big TV screen is important because I can't see a damn thing otherwise.
And like right now, it's the same. You can see me mostly from your
left
eye.
So I can't see any detail. Everything's very, very blurred. It's very interesting being a wheelchair racer when you can't see, especially being a road racer, because things tend to happen that you don't know are about to happen.
Oh, hang on. Where did that kangaroo come from?
Yes, exactly.
literally.
I'm watching the TV. My mum and dad are sat on the couch, which is underneath my TV, and I've looked at them and gone, I want to do that. I want to do a marathon. Now, imagine somebody who can barely see shit, that can't even transfer themselves off their bed into their wheelchair, who'd been stuck in bed for the best part of 9 years at this point, saying to you, I'm going to do a marathon in a wheelchair. They kind of looked at me and were like, oh, you'll go okay, honey, sure, you do that. And they were very, very supportive, but I think they were a bit confused.
Yeah, they were sort of like, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, but I think also they know how strong I am and how determined I am, and know when I set my mind to something, I just find a way of making it work. It took me 12 months from that point of not being able to get out of bed to pushing my first marathon. And it was the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. Finding something, God knows what, deep inside me to be able to push for 5 hours in a brand new racing wheelchair that I'd only had for 6 weeks at that point. So 42 kilometers with my arms. I pulled off my thumbnails. I've still got scars underneath my arms from where
I was looking at that before, actually. I thought it was like maybe a sticker or something.
That is a new one, but there are scars underneath it from
it's a new one, yeah.
You get it a lot with wheelchair racing.
I just
somehow managed to push myself to do it, and it was a crazy journey from pushing myself around in my day chair, just initially getting from my bed to the bathroom on my own.
Just those things. And this was just you were just doing this yourself.
Yeah.
Obviously you didn't have any coach training, I'll just do what I think is gonna help. And
yeah, my coach Adam didn't come along until maybe 6 months after I'd done that first marathon.
Right.
It took me near on 5 hours to finish it. Bearing in mind, it takes me about 2 hours now. So big difference. Yeah. And it's just funny how when you push yourself to do huge things, everything just spirals from there in good ways. Mm. Like my life from that day to this day has changed beyond all recognition. I've gone from somebody who's literally spent every moment of their day in bed watching TV because they've got nothing else to do, to running my own business, to being an elite athlete who's won medals, to speaking for a living and traveling all over the world and just doing crazy epic things that I didn't think were in my future and have just happened, not because I've necessarily planned those things from that point, but each step has led to the next, and I've just rolled with it and just said, you know what?
Literally.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
I see what you did there.
Literally.
Very good.
Yes. So, yeah, and that's it. I just say yes to every opportunity, and that's why I'm here now doing this, because you have to say yes. You have to.
You don't know.
No, exactly.
What's on the other side of the door,
and
either way, you're going to learn something.
And that so many people have chronic health issues and have disabilities, and I have a lot of issues outside of being in the wheelchair, my low vision, my vision. Mm-hmm. I'm type 1 diabetic. I have a paralyzed stomach, so I have to supplement food with a feeding tube just here. I have fibromyalgia, I have arthritis, so I have a lot of chronic pain issues. And even from those things, I wouldn't have been able to imagine the future I have now. But as things have got worse for me with my health, my life has gotten better because I've learned to just deal with things better. I think experiencing challenge, experiencing adversity, can really, really change you as a human being, can really help you to define your character and figure out who you are and what path you want to take. I mean, a three-year-old said this, I want to be a lawyer. That's all I ever wanted. I wanted to be a lawyer. And that's the path I followed until I was 27. I was a wills and probate lawyer. But this changed everything for me. My perspective changed, my outlook changed, and it's changed me into a more empathetic, understanding, caring person who really, really wants to make a difference. And I don't think I had that in me when I was younger. I see the world through lenses that are completely clear now, and I know exactly what I want, and I know the differences I want to see happen in the world. And I believe that the sport I do and the opportunities I've been given because of my pursuits are giving me the platform to really make this difference, and I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen. Yeah,
that's really inspiring. And like you said, I think the irony is I'm just loving listening to it. You know, as you said to me, how long I've been doing this and why I do it, it's to have conversations like this. And not necessarily to take something from it, but to understand. I'm interested in people, and I think, like you said, we go through life oftentimes and we're very unaware, we're very unperceptive of our environment around us. And it's not to say we need to know everything about anything and everything, because it's probably not possible. We can only retain so much information, but going through experiences, whatever we have, and we all face some of our own adversities, there's different levels, obviously.
Yeah.
But that builds the character. It's the archetype. It's the rock as it kind of goes through the river. It gets chipped and cracked and this and that. And that shapes it. You know, and you mentioned something before about that, how it shapes you as a person and your journey to be where you are now. And sometimes it's very different to the starting point. You know, you ask someone young, oh, what do you want to do? And it might be, I want to be a fireman. And sometimes that person does that. And then all of a sudden it flips on its head. With you, it was a lawyer. And now you're, like you said, you're a speaker, you're an athlete. You know, you're a source of inspiration. I guess some of it as well is, you would love to be able to give back, pay it forward. And you mentioned something quite salient before I want to go back to, which was the healthcare system. And I often find this digression between the two. We've got sort of this remediation of, let's just get people not dying and better. And then we've got this, like, let's get people beyond better and let's get them living their, as the kids say now, best life, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, I'll use an example of nutrition, because that's what my passion and one of my areas of expertise, and I love that. And I was always not interested in just like mediocrity. You know, I'm like, I don't like that. And there's a gentleman called the name of Sean Acor, and he writes and talks about the happiness advantage. It's one of the best TED Talks out there. And they were looking at, you know, you see these bell curve graphs, and he was looking at it one day and they were like, oh, you know, so this is kind of the average and this is this. And he goes, well, what about outliers? Like, what about these people at the top? He goes, well, we don't worry about them because they're already really happy.
Yeah.
And he goes, we don't study them. And he went, but hang on. So we study the bottom and the... So he was one of the first people to go, well, yeah, but let's learn from these people. Because obviously there's clues.
Yeah.
Like, and who the fuck wants to be... Who wants to have an average... If someone said you want an average life, average income, average relation, who the hell in the right mind is going to go, yeah, I'll take that?
No.
So it's about getting people, unlike you said, where you might have been, you could still be living that parallel life.
Yeah.
But imagine comparing it. Well, it's not even comparable almost, because as you said, it's worlds apart. Imagine other people out there, and I'm sure this is one of maybe the purposes of what you do, to try and help or at least give someone insight and go, hey, there is an option.
There is. Exactly.
But I think people, and I can completely empathize if I try with everything to put myself in that position and go, I can see why a lot of people want to give up.
Yeah.
And I have this conversation with my mom a lot as well, because, you know, and she's you know, an incredibly tenacious woman. She goes after it and she puts the effort in.
Yeah.
And I know sometimes that she finds it difficult because, and I can see the frustration, and it's you know, it's upsetting. But I try not to push her.
Mm.
But I understand, or I can just try and put myself, going, I'd understand why you're pissed off.
Yeah.
Because it's like you said before, it's like you feel robbed. And because, again, probably like yourself, I don't know, but maybe you lived a pretty healthy life until you probably weren't abusing drugs, doing this, doing that. And my mom never had, and she goes, fucking, why have I got this? You know, it's like, well, and I've always said, look, and I sort of use people like yourself and as examples, like, look, you can do this. Like, if you want to do something, yeah, it might not be the way you would have done it, but there is, you'd be surprised.
And
you know?
I think quite often the best way of dealing with shit that happens to you is to find the positives in it. Mm. So I think a lot of people say to me, well, you know, if you had your time again, would you want it to be different? No, I wouldn't. I'd still choose to go through everything I've been through. It's not been easy. Like,
no.
The world is a really, really hard place when you know, so many things aren't accessible, so many things aren't inclusive, but I have been so blessed to meet an incredible community of people that just are so accepting of difference and are so accepting of just, you know, life being a challenge, that I wouldn't have met these people. I wouldn't have met any of them. And I think that the friendships and the bonds and the opportunities I have that are purely because of my disability, I wouldn't have had. And I think finding those positives, understanding that, yeah, you've got all the shit happening here, but there's all these good things too, and that far outweighs the shit. You've got to focus on that stuff, because it is very, very easy to get into the mindset of, oh, you know, life sucks, it's hard, there are so many challenges, I can't be bothered with this, oh, I'm sick of having to do that. Because there is a lot of that, there is. And I think there are so many people in life, regardless of whether you have a disability or a health condition, that face those kind of challenges every day. Everybody has their challenges. So you can apply that mindset to whatever challenges it is that you are going through, regardless of how small or big they are. But finding the positive within the negative is the best way to deal with it. Yeah.
Have you heard of a book called The Obstacle Is the Way?
I haven't, actually.
It's got a list of books, but some of the, like, again, these key ones. And this is, I think it was James Clear. I could be getting that mixed up. Anyway, ultimately, the premise is what you've just said. Mm. The obstacle is the way.
Yeah, 100%.
And people are consistently running away from the obstacle. And it's like, it doesn't matter how you over, under, through, down, jump, teleport, whatever. The answers you seek are in that obstacle.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you've done by going, well, in your situation, you've got no fucking option. I can't run away from this one, literally.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, sorry, there's another pun again.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
That's all right. I'm terrible for them, so it's all good.
But, like, you know, you're there and it's something that just has to be done. And the dramatic irony, because it is ironic, because this thing staring you in the face is the thing we need to do. It's the thing that scares you the most you need to do.
Embrace your fear.
Literally run towards it.
Yeah.
And time feeds it. So it's, you know, if people, and you mentioned, you know, we've all got our problems, and it's not about who's got the worst. It's not about a game.
No.
We just want better problems.
Yeah.
But ultimately now, and I was speaking to a client before about this, because, again, she's going through a bit of a tough time, and I said, look, what you're facing right now, like the exact thing that you're trying to negotiate away from is what you need to negotiate through, with, over, under, that it, and it's not easy. It's not meant to be easy.
Yeah.
If we don't experience opposite emotions, if we don't have pain, if we don't have frustration, if we don't have anger, how can we experience happiness, excitement, elation? We'd just be numb.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the chronological order we're going in. What I'd like to understand is, and you mentioned before, is as someone who has a passion for, again, nutrition and training and strength training, I want to understand the mechanistics of your training and the nutrition.
Yep.
And you did sort of allude to, again, how that works. Can you give us a bit of a breakdown of maybe where you were with nutrition and how it's evolved, not only in terms of your condition, but also fueling your workouts now? We talked a little bit about that before.
Yeah.
And also, again, how the evolution of your training went from, you know, pulling your fingernails off and blistering yourself, and I'm sure this is a bit of that now. And whether it was Adam, your coach, who comes in and periodizes that for you, I'd love to know what your training and nutrition looks like. How does it feel? Give us some insight.
Okay. So I'll tell you where I'm at now, and then I can explain exactly how I've got to this point. So my training at the moment is 6 days a week. I get into my racing wheelchair 4 of those days. Each session takes around about an hour and a half. I will do, it's 2 distance sessions a week, so usually 15 to 20 kilometers. I'll do 1 session which purely focuses on starts and shorter distances on the track, so 1, 2, or 400. And then I'll do 1 interval session at the track, which is usually 1500 intervals, and is around about 10 kilometers over the whole session. So they're quite intense, high intensity training sessions.
Apart from the obvious, with a great, I'm looking at your wheelchair here. Yeah. I imagine that this is the one you spend most of the time in.
So this is just my day chair. So I have got 2 chairs.
Okay.
So I've got my day chair, which is just a titanium frame chair. Wheels pull off, unlike the older style. Unlike the older style hospital chairs that collapse and fold up, this is an active wheelchair. So it means anyone who's active and gets themselves around, they're mostly built for people that are paraplegic, but so they're not able to mobilize themselves, but need the stability and mobility of a easy to use wheelchair. The wheels have a little bit of camber on, so it's easy to turn, and the spokes are carbon fiber with push rims that are wider and flatter than the standard hospital ones and have rubber.
It looks like I'm looking at it like a road bike tire.
Yeah, it is. It isn't exactly that. It is a road bike tire. So so it's a very, very different setup to what you would imagine a hospital style wheel, old fashioned, that maybe an elderly person or somebody who doesn't use their wheelchair all the time may use. So my racing wheelchair is completely different in that it's carbon fiber. It's 72 inches long. I know that dimension. Can't tell you what that is in centimeters. Because it's an American made chair, but it's 72 inches long. So there's a lot of camber on them. Carbon fiber 4 spoked wheels. It's a carbon fiber fork at the front with a carbon fiber smaller wheel at the front. I can lift it with like 1 finger. It's ridiculously light. It's very going downhill. If you're going down a very steep long hill, you can get up to about 60k an hour in one of those things. So it can be scary.
Yeah,
especially when you can't see what's in front of you.
Well, you got a right terrapin.
That happened to me a few years ago at Bridge to Brisbane. I didn't realise there was a turn at the end of the hill and there was barriers there, and I didn't see them until I was just before it, and I tried to turn in time and the chair didn't get round the bend, and I ended up falling. The chair fell over and I broke my collarbone. There were still 2 2.5 k's left of the race, and I decided to finish it.
I was going to say, you cracked on, why not? I was like, you got back in. I did.
With all
the adrenaline, you probably didn't know. You probably like, that's sore, I'll figure that
out.
Yeah, I did.
And I got to the finish line and stopped and went, oh, that hurts. I better go to hospital. I'm like, all cut up. But, you know, I finished the race, so that's the main thing.
So, and when you're doing these races as well as uphill, I imagine downhill, it's just whatever the wherever the terrain is.
Yeah.
There's no sort of segregation as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned time in the chair. What? So how do we, I imagine upper body strength is obviously key.
Yes.
I see you a lot on the ski erg, obviously you see a lot doing core upper body.
Yeah.
Do you do any lower body or core as well?
I do a lot of core. I've got a very, very strong core. So my spinal cord function is classified as T10. So basically my paralysis is below the waist. But because I've managed to do a lot of upper core work, I've managed to activate some of my lower core muscles. And I've got a little bit of movement in my hip flexors.
Can you feel?
I can feel. So parts of my legs, I can't feel anything. I've got no sensation at all. But other parts of my legs, I've got hypersensitivity. So nothing feels the way it should.
So like if you almost touch your knee, if that's a sensitive area, it might not feel like it.
Yeah, it's a really... really strange thing to be able to do. So somebody could, for example, put a pin into my leg, and in certain parts of it I wouldn't feel it, but in other parts it would feel like a cold sensation rather than a sharp sensation. Or somebody could tickle my leg and it would feel like severe intense pain. So there's a real disconnect between what's actually going on and what my brain understands is going on. What really, really freaks my coach Adam out, and you're going to meet Adam at some point.
Not
this
Adam. Oh, is it true?
is me being able to wiggle my toes. I can wiggle my toes. Yes. So I can't move my legs at all, but I can wiggle my toes.
See, this is where I think there's some, and it's the same. You know, when I think about my mom and my condition and whatnot, and, understanding autoimmune diseases in general. It's just like the wires are a bit cross, right? I know I'm probably oversimplifying this, but we look at bone, we look at tendon, we look at ligament, we look at muscle. It's like we're pretty good at a lot of these things, but it's the nerves, we just still can't quite grasp it. And I know we're getting a lot better, and I don't know how well you follow Elon and what you think of him, but I think he's at least trying. And, we look at the neural link, and he's
trying to do it. 100%.
And eventually you'll put that in, and it will rewire, and all of a sudden you'll just get up and start walking.
Yeah.
That'd be beautiful. I'm sure you don't rest on your laurels, but I truly believe, but I'm an optimist as well.
Yeah.
And I've always been fascinated with biology, and that's probably why I do what I do, because I like to remold people.
Yeah.
Not only from a neuroplasticity perspective, but also from a physical perspective. I'm just very interested in not changing people for change, but evolving people. I don't really call it a transformation, because it is an evolution. And being able to take someone or enhance someone in a way, shape, or form of their desire that maybe they didn't think was possible. Mm. And I'm just totally fascinated how you can literally do that without a scalpel.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like a plastic surgeon would do.
Yeah.
But I am of that, and a lot of the conversations I've had, whether it's on my podcast or just growing up or reading, I truly believe there's a formula there, and we are yet to crack it. I mean, just think about where we are now, and I truly believe in the future we'll be able to get in and overcome a lot of autoimmune diseases. I don't know when that's going to be, and maybe some people might say that's wishful thinking, but I truly believe we can.
We never thought that there would be insulin, like for type 1 diabetes, and in prior to 1920, 1930, if you were a type 1 diabetic, your life expectancy was a few months. Whereas now our life expectancy is only a little bit less than the average life expectancy. So and that purely became down to the discovery of insulin and the availability of insulin for people. And medical technology changes constantly. There's always constant things happening. I read an article this morning how somebody had been given some form of stem cell treatment, and they have now been insulin independent for 276 days. Now, that means that the cure for type 1 could be within my lifetime. And that is just an incredible thing, because people don't really understand just how awful a disease type 1 diabetes is. Yes. And just and what you have to live with. And it doesn't just mean you can't eat sugar. It's got nothing to do with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Really,
it is a life-limiting disease, and it is something where the decisions you're making every single day affect whether you live that day or die that day. And it really is as simple as that. The one decision, like getting in the car without glucose and being stuck in traffic on the highway, could mean that you will die that day because you didn't have your supplies with you. And people just don't understand how important that is. Yeah.
I only have some empathy because of the clients I've worked with for years, and just obviously working with them on a very close basis and having conversations every week and going, and it's not the mechanistic science of it. Like, no. I understand that.
Yeah.
It's like you said, it's the implementation of it. It's like, like for example, one of my clients in defense, he rides bikes and came around in my house, but there we go for a bike, and he goes, and he has a little pack on the back of his bike. He's always got it there. And I always ask him.
Yeah.
He goes, actually, good to go. He goes, can I grab a banana? And it's not because he's hungry.
Yeah.
It's because the blood glucose levels, right? He's like, I'm just not sure about that. He's like, I should be all right, Mike. I'll grab you a banana.
Yeah.
There you go. And it's as simple as that, right? Now, I would never think about that. I would go, oh, I'm hungry. Like,
yeah, sure, exactly. Exactly.
And like you said, it's something that causes adaptation. There was, I'll tell you a slightly funny story, but when I was studying nutrition, I had a nutrition teacher called Lillian, she's from South Africa, very good, very funny, very comical in her approach. And when we were going through, you know, looking at diabetes and the effects of it, and, you know, some of those protocols, she said, like a lot of things, if you become very in tune with it and you really understand it, you can have a better relationship with it.
Yeah.
There are a percentage of people who choose to kind of be a bit ignorant to it.
Yeah.
And I see that a lot, and I'm like, man, you can have a much better experience if you just understood some nutrition.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe took the health seriously. And that is uncanny to me, because I'm like, I was in a position, I know I'm pro-health, but I'm like, I'd be doing everything within my power to make this as easy as possible.
Yeah.
And there was this particular individual who used to purposely run everything low so we could eat ice cream. But she goes, I'm only telling you this to show you an example of what could be achieved, but I do not condone it. He got really good at it. So he could eat loads and run it on the limit.
Oh,
he's fine.
Yeah.
He stopped being so, maybe, you know, I guess a little bit lavish with it now.
But yeah.
I just thought that was interesting, that example and the way, you know, she said, she goes, I tell you this because I want to understand where. So you might have person A, B, and C over here, but this person has chosen to go. He just takes it seriously.
Yeah.
But to go, how? He's thinking about this.
It's really funny. When I was my late teens, early 20s, I stopped taking insulin, which is just the most ridiculous thing you could do as a type 1 diabetic.
One thing you don't do is stop.
Yeah. It's really not a good idea. I had heard that the best way to lose weight was to not take insulin. And it's true, it's the best way to lose weight. However, what happens is your blood becomes poisonous and you become acidotic and your body starts eating away at your internal organs and eventually you die. And it doesn't take very, very long for that process to happen. So yes, I lost weight, and I went down to about 40 kilos. Probably 6 months, and I was, I did very, very well.
What were you doing, just trying to manage it with food?
I was going very, very low carb, and at that time, my pancreas was still working a tiny, tiny bit, so I still had a little bit of my own insulin there. If I did that now, I'd be dead within days, because I have none of my own insulin production whatsoever. But I suffered a lot of eating disorders as a teenager, so for me it was very easy to do that to myself. But if I look back at what I did, I didn't function. I looked like a skeleton. I just, you know, black holes and rings around my eyes. I just looked terrible and I felt terrible and my brain didn't function and I was just so focused on food. But yes, it's funny the things you do to yourself in the sake of vanity. Like now, I just train hard. You know, I train hard. I eat well. I these days, it's all about keeping my blood sugars within the perfect range and being as fit and healthy as possible. Because and it's mostly to do with the crap I've been through. Because I don't want extra challenges, health challenges on top of what I'm already dealing with. Diabetes is something that I can mostly control. You can never completely control it because stress, illness, even something you've chosen to eat that day can completely affect where you're at, but you can do your best to control it, and that's what I try to do. Yeah.
I really wish that more females could, you know, understand that it's one of the main areas I spend a lot of time on, and it seems to affect females more for understandable reasons.
Yes.
The relationship with the scales and the weight is uncanny. Like women who stand on the scales were not out of shape, but I get it because they're living their own reality, and we have to empathise with that. And just going, people would kill to be in your shoes, and you're upset because you went slightly heavier.
It's
even understanding
it's so
that
hard.
It's not about just there's so many things that affect weight.
Yeah.
And they want to starve themselves. Yeah. I'm like, you're perfectly good. And again, one of the key things I try to implement is let's focus on performance, and the physique will come. The athlete, I think the athlete's a great example, and I use this a lot of the time. Every type of athlete, and look at their physique, it's a purely an adaptation of the stimulus provided by what they've done. They didn't go, I want to look like a sprinter. They went, I need to run from this point to that point in the shortest distance possible. And by doing this training and fueling myself in this way and getting this sleep, I get that.
Yeah.
As a byproduct, I look like this.
Yeah.
And you look at a swimmer, look at the development. It's different than it is to a javelin thrower, than a sprinter, to someone who's in a wheelchair race.
Yeah.
It's a complete adaptation. And I think it's a definitive because people are visual. If they look at that and they look at all the different types, you start to go, oh, okay, yeah. So maybe focusing on the performance goal rather than, like you said, I love physique sports, but there's a part of it, and I talk a lot of people out of it, I segregate it, I don't recommend it for a lot of people. I said, what you've got to understand is, we got up there to look completely shredded, to get judged by five people in tan and underwear, and people get upset about it, and we can't even fucking perform.
Yeah.
Where I say, let's look at our brothers and sisters, powerlifters. They still look damn pretty jacked, depending on what weight category they're in. Yeah, I know some of them carry a bit of weight, right? But they have a definitive goal to move a load from point A to point B, or whatever it is. I'm like, that really should be, and I'm not trying to rubbish physique sports, because it's a beautiful thing, but I think we've lost it a little bit in terms of, at least there's a definitive outcome there. Like, at least we, you know, there's a performance goal, and sometimes by focusing on that, there is a better relationship, and all of a sudden, the physique came anyway.
Yeah, I think with the physique sports especially, there's such a focus on how you look that you become obsessed with the food side of things, and that obsession is not a good thing. And that, you know, people have said to me before, why don't you compete in, you know, wheelchair bodybuilding? Not a chance in hell, because I know personally, I get obsessive about food. Yeah. And if I did that to myself, I would go back to being a person with an eating disorder, and that's not where I want to be. What I'm doing now as an athlete, I'm competitive, I get to train, I'm fit, I'm healthy, but I get to be healthy with my food choices too, and that is so important.
Yeah,
so important. Yeah.
You get to live.
Yeah, exactly.
You get to eat food you like.
Yeah.
That not only, you know, satiate or even from like a cultural or, you know, a lifestyle perspective, it brings people together for enjoyment.
Yeah.
But it fuels the goal.
Exactly.
So it's a beautiful combo.
Yeah. It's a great 100%.
Thing. Let's look at then walk us through a day or roll us through a day in the life. I'd love as much detail as you want, whatever you feel comfortable sharing from start to finish. Do us like maybe a training day, because I know you train most days.
Yeah.
I'd love to know nutrition, food, sleep, rest, recovery, training, all of it. Whatever you feel comfortable sharing. Because I'm interested myself in this.
Okay.
And I do find, like I said to you,
I'm probably not the best example with everything, because my body has a lot of effect on you know, sleep, stuff like that. But
there's
so
a lot of
there is. So for me, I'm up most days at around about 5 o'clock. My best friend, coach, business partner, Adam, picks me up at six. We head to the gym. I never eat before training. I can't eat before training. If I do, it makes me vomit. So I have to get my morning training session out of the way. Usually in the mornings, I will do a hour and a half track or distance session, depending on which day of the week it is.
Does it matter whether it's raining or not?
Raining does have an impact. So it's important in a racing chair to get experience in the wet, because you can never control what's going to happen in a competition. However, you're not actually pushing a chair, grabbing onto the wheels like you, or onto your push rims like you would in a normal wheelchair. You have, there's two types of gloves that you wear, but both of them, your hands are like this and you're pushing on like a flat surface. So it's using the friction of the glove against the rubber that's on your push rim to push. So you're not grabbing, because if you're grabbing, you're slowing yourself down. The whole point is to keep the momentum going. So if there's any wet, that friction is reduced and your ability to get around a course or a track is greatly reduced. You have to practice in those conditions occasionally, but
something with a bit more rubber.
Yeah, well, the thing is, there's just not the options for this. There isn't. We use there's something called tack that you put on the wheels that gives you a bit of extra stickiness there to try and. But during training, it's a pain in the ass to try and use it, so we generally don't. But I try to avoid wet weather training too much, because I generally end up with injuries. I have a lot of bursitis issues in my shoulders, and if I put that kind of added pressure onto them, it doesn't end well. So I will train in the wet, but if it's spitting, but as soon as it gets too wet, I try to stay away from it. I know some athletes like to do the wet weather training, but for me, it's more about protection of my shoulders, because obviously it's not like if I injure my shoulder, I can't get around. Yeah, I can't move. Yeah, it's my if my shoulders aren't working, then my ability to even get into my wheelchair on a day-to-day basis or do anything is greatly affected. So I have to be really protective of that. It's not like I can just get up and walk somewhere. For me, I will stay away from a wet weather session. After I've been in the race chair, I'll usually go and get something to eat. I don't eat a huge amount of carbohydrate because of my paralyzed stomach. I have to be really, really careful with what I eat. I usually stick to either chicken, low starch vegetables that are really well cooked, because anything that's not really soft, I can't digest. I do allow myself some chocolate occasionally.
Is that one of your favorite treats?
Yeah, it is. Chocolate, milk chocolate. I love it. Yeah. Just plain milk chocolate for me works
like
really
Galaxy,
well. Oh man, I miss Galaxy. Galaxy. Really?
Yeah. I got some from my friend the other day.
Oh my God.
Chocolate. And I said, have you ever tried Galaxy? She's Australian. She goes, no. So I got, honestly, it's just,
I'm going.
Go and grab
some. Oh, my God,
it's special.
Oh.
And then you're not had it for years.
Yeah.
And you go, is it as good?
Yeah, it is. English chocolate is, yeah, English chocolate is good. Sorry, Aussie guys, but English chocolate does take the...
It has something to do with the temperature.
Yeah.
They have a different combination.
Yeah, and the milk solids as well. It's slightly different. But I'll go and get some food. And then get a couple of hours working. I run a business called Invincible. We do motivational speaking and run workshops and do accessibility consulting, inclusion training, that kind of stuff. So usually try to get slot 3 or 4 hours worth of work in there before then heading to the gym in the afternoon. At the gym, we do 20 minutes either on the ski ergs or on the hand grinder just to get warmed up and try and get the heart rate up a bit. And then it's an hour strength training. And then what we do, obviously, because we're not using our lower half, is we separate our sessions into chest, back, buys and tries, shoulders, and then we do like a more functional session on a Wednesday. So 5 days a week in the gym.
And you usually make free weights or machines or a combination?
A combination of both. It often depends what gym we're at. When we're at the EMF gyms, we're lucky to be able to use most of the equipment. Sadly, most smaller gyms, the equipment just isn't accessible. Either things are too high to reach, or the seats aren't adjustable, or whatever it is, which is hugely problematic when you can't stand up to reach things. So yeah, what I really like about EMF is the adjustability. It works well for us. So
that's different, like you get kinesis, pinball,
yes. I love the kinesis machines, they're great. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
So you just go, you don't have to really adjust anything apart from yourself.
Yeah.
So you just go, oh yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's great. And I also like to try and get about half an hour swimming in most days. And on a weekend, I'll do a 2-hour swim session where I try to do about 3 or 4 kilometers if I can. So
yeah, you're on the go a lot.
Yes.
I imagine yes. It's very much therapy as well.
Yeah.
I know it is for a lot of people.
Yeah, it is.
Like you'd be lost without it.
For me, it's my pain relief. It's the only thing that keeps my pain at bay. If I haven't got a decent session in the day, I really, really suffer. I used to be on a huge number of opiates, ridiculous amounts of opiate medication to try and keep control of my pain. But about 12 months ago, I managed to come off everything, and I put it purely down to exercise. And I also use something called a Molly suit, which is a suit that has 52 electrodes that are placed in different parts of the body, and it stimulates the nervous system. It's a bit like a TENS machine, but it's everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah, and it's amazing. Twice a week. So it works in athlete recovery, but it also helps with pain. It helps for anyone with any kind of neurological condition or spasticity or anything like that to really get your nervous system in the best shape it can
be.
Yeah, it's and
it
really
is.
No, I've got my own suit, but for the sake of transparency, I'm an ambassador for them. But I would seriously recommend it to anyone, because I find it's been life changing.
We'll talk about this in a bit, but people can just reach out to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can put them in touch with whoever they need to, but. It's been truly life. Molly suit. So MOLLII.
Is it an acronym?
No, I don't. I actually don't know what it stands for. I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out. They're actually a Dutch company, I believe. Yeah, I think they're Dutch. I know it's Scandinavia somewhere. So it could be.
That word in their language has a meaning.
Yeah.
Which would be like mobility.
But anyway, yes, that plus exercise has just transformed my life. But I do notice if I miss either a Molly session or a training session, like I become a very moody individual.
Yeah. Right, so.
But yes, yeah. So once I've done my 2 training sessions and my swim session for the day, I usually head home or help Adam out with his 5-year-old. I'm sure he'll tell you all about that at some point. He, great kid, like amazing kid.
Lots
and oh, huge amount of energy. I'm the one that often, little boy, and he's, I'm often the one that gets sent to the play center with him so to run off some of the energy. Yeah, you go, bye-bye. But yeah, it's all in good fun. Then I get home and get a few hours working for the evening before having a shower and relaxing to try and get some sleep. Generally, I don't get off to sleep much before 11, 12 o'clock, if I'm honest. So I get about 5 to 6 hours sleep a night, but I used to only get 3, so it's an improvement for me.
I imagine that's well, the training facilitates.
Yes.
Sleep.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're ready, well, you're probably more tired than what it means.
Yeah.
Is
100%.
It just because you don't sleep in terms of you don't feel tired, or you find trouble with the neurological just connection to try and even induce sleep?
Probably a little column A, a little column B. I've never been a person that sleeps much for, as long as I can remember, I've never needed sleep. But certainly the disconnect there since I've had the neurological stuff going on has made it more difficult.
Because you don't look tired.
I'm not.
Because usually you can tell people who like have a lapse.
Yeah.
They're really, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or there is a small percentile of people, very small, which everyone thinks they are, and most people aren't.
Yeah.
That only require 5 to 6
yeah.
hours, but it usually comes at the mercy of.
It's really strange. I do think I'm one of those people that doesn't need a lot of sleep, that can just keep going no matter what. I do think that some things suffer because of it occasionally. I do have times when I'm extremely fatigued, but I think it's more when my health is being a bit off, and I get greater affected because of it. It's just one of those things.
It is. It's, yeah. Again, you find the balance.
Yeah, exactly.
You take the wins where you can, you make these, which you already are. I mean, you're making incremental improvements over time.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is great. I want to ask, there's a couple of questions before we wrap up, and there's probably a lot more as well, but this is a great sort of peak, I guess, that we can always look at. We've discussed maybe with Adam and yourself, and maybe doing a bit of a part 2 and 3.
Yeah.
These next questions are rapid fire, and they're a little bit fun. In nature, so whatever springs to mind, and then I have my final question, which I have for my guest.
Yeah.
So these three, whatever comes to mind, is purely fun. You can literally make up anything, but I am interested to know. And the first one is, if you could choose any superpower and you can make one up, what would it be and why?
Ooh, probably to fly. I think flying would be fun. Could fly over people and scare the shit out of them.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. You'll pick flying, but then have to
do
it. No,
I know. I'm a bit of a prankster.
I'd like to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be pretty fun.
Yeah.
The second one is, if you could choose to have dinner with anyone, dead or alive, and you can choose up to 3 people, and this will change because the more you think about this, the more you start to think about different people, but as of now, who would you choose to have at that table?
Oh God, that's a really hard question. It's funny because I've been asked this before and I can never come up with an answer because I'm so lucky in that I've actually got to meet a lot of people that I've wanted to. And my dad was a professional football player back in the UK, back in the proper football, soccer back in the UK, and I've been very, very lucky to mix with circles of people that that have inspired and motivated me throughout my entire life, and I can't actually sit here right now and say there's somebody that I really, really, really would love to do that with. Our mate, and it's Barack Obama.
I
love the way he talks, and I think he'd be really, really interesting just to have a conversation with. His skill as an orator is really interesting, and I just think it would be fascinating to talk to him one-on-one. But outside of that, there isn't anyone I can truly think of that I'd be like, yeah, you. Yeah.
It is. It's a tough one.
It's
like asking people, you know, what their favourite food is.
Yeah.
It's always a bit tough.
Yes.
Know? So whatever comes to mind, but it's like, oh, it could be this, it could be that.
Yeah.
You've got the name The Invincible Woman.
Yes.
First of all, I'm going to ask another rapid-fire question on that, but just quickly, how did that come about?
So I came up with
apart from now, I can see why.
Yeah. I came up with the business name Invincible, so obviously invincible, but the able, disability, that kind of stuff.
My last guest is Iken. Iken is last name, so I can dance.
I like it. Yeah. I liked the whole idea of invincible as a thing because I want to show people that people with disabilities can be and are invincible, that we can keep going and that we have strength and power and all those kind of things. And I wanted to have my business name within my Instagram handle. I wanted to show that I feel that I am invincible because of the things I've been through, and show that resilience and strength in my name, I guess. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I guess to partner with that, and this is a question which inspires many more conversations, but as a rapid fire one-off, if you could choose to live forever, would you? If you had the ability.
Ooh, no, probably not. I'd like to live long enough to make my mark in the world and leave a legacy, but I I want to live a short, productive, happy life, not live forever with issues and not old age and that kind of stuff, where I'm sure that my body will become very tired and all those other things, given all the existing stuff I've got on. So I'd like to make a short yet productive life and bring joy and happiness in the world and make change. That's all I ask for. A eternal life, I don't think it would. And also, everybody around you would be dying, and
the more you think about that question, the more it elucidates the pro and the cons.
Yeah.
The immediate reaction is yes, but then you really think deeply, but then it just starts to. You can have a podcast on that.
Yeah, 100%.
And you can have like a debate.
All sorts,
And this is why I ask these questions, because they're thought provoking.
Yeah.
But they inspire more. I think quality over quantity.
Yeah, 100%.
Which I think is key.
Yeah.
So, you know, people say, oh, I'm here for a good time and a long time. I'm like, well, you can kind of be here for kind of both. In terms of, like, longevity is obviously whatever it is to the individual based on what you have. But like you said, you live a life which has purpose, quality, you can leave a mark, you do something positive. It's far greater than living a long, dragged out life.
Exactly.
Misery,
exactly.
Which is not good for anyone.
Yeah.
The last question, Tash, is, can you identify a fear that you had or that you've currently got in your life? What it was, what it is, what you learned from it, or what you are learning from it? If it is still current, because I'm always interested in that.
Because
I think fear is at the elixir of unlocking our true potential.
To be honest, my fear is going back to where I was before, being stuck in bed all the time and not being able to pursue everything that I am now. And for that reason, it's probably my biggest driving factor. I don't ever want to go back there, and it's why I do so much to maintain my health and my fitness, because these are the things that so far have kept me relapse free since 2012. So I am obsessive about my training and about my nutrition and about all those kind of things, because I don't ever want to go back there, and that has to be my greatest fear, because it was a horrible life. I don't ever want to not be able to live my life with passion and purpose, and I think that if I did end up back there, that would mentally be a very, very tough situation to deal with. I deal with it because that's what I do, but at the same time, I don't want to ever put myself in that situation. When it comes to fear, though, I'm one of these people that doesn't really have a lot of fear, and if I do, I just face it straight on, because it's the only way you're ever going to get over it.
But it's true.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. It's often fear is if you let it, it's a motivating factor.
Yeah.
But running away from it just makes it worse.
You'll never achieve anything if you let fear control you. And it's true, the saying that the best things happen at the end of your comfort zone. So push outside your comfort zone, because eventually good things will happen. And all the good things that have happened in my life have been because I've been scared and I've said yes anyway. And it's just true. It's not one of those motivational bullshit sayings that you see out there. It is highly true that when you do that and you allow yourself to see fear as a good thing, that you're more likely to achieve your potential. So, yeah.
Couldn't agree more. And I'd say that's quite an appropriate way to finish off what's been a sobering, inspirational, and very motivating conversation. Tasha, I really appreciate the time.
No worries.
Thank you for making the time.
My pleasure. Yeah,
my
pleasure.
For me. I've got my
good
daily, weekly motivation.
Good.
I'm sure a lot of people will derive that.
Awesome.
People who, you know, perhaps want to ask you some questions, or they want to know more, they want to follow along with your journey, they may want to reach out. Where are the best places for them to do so?
Okay, they can reach out via my website, tashaprice.com. You can visit me on Instagram at the_invincible_woman, or you can reach out to me on Facebook at Invincible Official.
Yeah. Perfect. And as ever, I will put all the links, so for everyone watching, for everyone listening, whatever platform you're on. I'll put those in the show notes, the links in the descriptions. Make sure you do.
Awesome.
Tash, thanks again for your time.
No
worries. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And I'm sure we'll do it again or again. We'll amalgamate a part two with Adam.
Awesome.
It'll be great. Guys, for everyone watching and listening, really appreciate your time. If you really enjoyed this, again, share it with someone who you think will enjoy it. I've got to say it. Like, comment, subscribe, leave a rating and a review. And until next time, you guys already know. Stay fearless.
Bye.
For those of you who are confused, frustrated, and sick and tired of not seeing the results that you want or deserve, make sure that you click the Apply for Coaching button in the description below and line up a completely free consultation with myself where we can discover if it's a good fit as client and coach and take your health and physique to the next level once and for all.